For millions of high school seniors, the college application process is almost over. Letters of acceptance and rejection are starting to trickle into mailboxes around the country. Now it's time for high school juniors to begin the grueling race to get into college. But as Andrew Ferguson learned the hard way, they should have started earlier, years earlier. Ferguson recently helped his son with the application process, an experience he writes about in his new book, Crazy You, One Dad's Crash Course in Getting His Kid into College. Andrew Ferguson, who's a senior editor at the Weekly Standard, joins us in our studio. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're not writing about getting into just any college. You're talking about kids and parents who want their kids to get into, I guess you would call it, the right college, a selective college. What colleges are we talking about?
There actually are gradations that people in the industry use, which is highly selective, selective, less selective, and then below that. And I think that most of the people sort of in the middle class of America really have their sights set on that selective school or even the highly selective school or even, be still my heart, Harvard or Yale. So this is a book not just about how to get your kid into school, but about the experience of trying to get your kid into school and surviving it, and, you know, these very particular kinds of schools.
Now, when you got started with your son, right away you came up against this feeling that you had started too late. He was a junior,
yes.
And you felt almost immediately this was way too late.
Right.
Is that true, really? Or
yeah, I think it is true in a sense. How it happened was I went to see a smart and efficient woman who charges $40,000 to parents to get their kids into school. And it's sort of a soup-to-nuts program that she gets. She gets the kids when they're in junior high or freshman in high school and teaches them how to write college application essays and how to train for the SAT. And I went up to see her talk to a kind of a seminar, and I had people telling me that they had started compiling their brag sheets, as they're called, kind of horrifyingly, for their children all the way back into fourth and fifth grade. So they'd been collecting things like videos of their athletic performances, tapes of music recitals that they'd done, papers they'd written, mentions they might have had in the local paper. And so you just have to remember, when your kid is applying to school, he's competing against parents who have been at this a lot longer than you have.
Well, it makes you think that maybe an average kid can't get into these schools.
Well, an average kid can get into it because it's totally irrational. Let's say the college admissions officer thinks the tuba player in the band really stinks and they need a new tuba player in the marching band. And he goes looking through all the applications to find the great tuba player. So it may be somebody without a great SAT score, without a great GPA, but who's really damn good at the tuba.
Well, one of the things you talk about, too, is that kids have to be sort of self-promoters in order to do this.
It's awful. And it was, when you start to fill out an application, a college application, which is really just a questionnaire, which is very simple to fill out, but the hard part is the college essay. The college essays are generally questions that call upon emotions that don't necessarily come easily to a kid like mine. I was talking to a college counselor once, and we were having a terrible time writing these essays because they were questions like, you know, tell us your most embarrassing moment, or, you know, if you could be a puppy, what kind of puppy would you be? You know, stuff like that. And my son's just pulling his hair out. And I said, I don't know how to help him. And she said, well, just tell him that he has to dig down deep and, you know, tell us his innermost thoughts. And I said, lady, he's a 17-year-old boy. He doesn't have innermost thoughts. And if he did, you wouldn't want to know what they were, and neither would I. But this is the kind of bind that you get yourself into.
Yeah. You almost give the feeling that that you would be a bad parent if you didn't buy into
all this. Well, I certainly wouldn't say that. But there are a lot of people around, and it was said to me, this college counselor I met, she said sort of jokingly, but she said, bad dad, when I told her that we hadn't taken an SAT prep class or done a college tour yet. And he was a junior at the time. And I did feel like a bad dad, but on the other hand, I didn't sort of decide that I was going to give up parenthood or all the kinds of things that we had in our family that still bound us together. You know, people say, what's your one bit of advice? And I say, you'll hate to hear it, but my piece of advice is relax. Your kid's going to get in somewhere. It'll probably be in the top three of the schools that they wanted to get into. the kid will be happy, and you'll survive yourself.
And your son did, in fact, get into a school that he was happy about.
Yes, absolutely. Our first meeting with his college counselor at high school involved him telling the counselor what kind of school he wanted, and my son, being my son, said, look, I want to go to a school where I can go to a football game, take off my shirt, paint my chest in the school colors, and major in beer. And you should have seen the look on that college. This is the guy who was going to write him his recommendation. I was just delighted that my son was like that. But as it turns out, that's where he went. He hasn't painted his chest yet, but pretty close, I think. And he's definitely majoring in beer.
Andrew Ferguson is a senior editor of the Weekly Standard. His new book is Crazy You, One Dad's Crash Course in Getting His Kid into College. Thanks. It was fun talking to you.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Today marks an historic moment for Catholics in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. It's the first Sunday for their first Latino Archbishop, Jose Gomez. He now leads the largest and most diverse Catholic flock in the country. From member station KPCC, Sandon Totten reports on what the new Archbishop brings to the job and the challenges he'll face.
Our Lady Queen of Angels Church sits in downtown Los Angeles. It's modeled after an old California mission, complete with a bell tower and adobe walls. Most of the masses here are in Spanish. Father Richard Estrada says his congregation represents the future of the Catholic Church in L.A.
We're 99% immigrant church, Latino church. On Sundays, we'll have maybe 2,000-3,000 people that come in through the day.
Latinos make up 70% of all Catholics in the Archdiocese, and that number is growing. Keeping the Latinos engaged is crucial for the long-term survival of the church. And that might be part of the reason Pope Benedict XVI named Jose Gomez as the new archbishop. Gomez was born in Monterrey, Mexico, and he's a longtime advocate for immigrant rights. He says when the Vatican called with his new assignment, the conversation was straightforward.
They asked me, but they didn't give me a chance to say no.
That's Gomez speaking during a conference call shortly after the announcement last year. It was a humorous moment from a man not known for his sense of humor.
I think he recognized that people perceived him as being overly formal, and he lamented that.
Bishop Oscar Cantu worked with Gomez for 2.5 years at his previous assignment in San Antonio. Cantu says, humor aside, Gomez was known for his devotion to the church, his love of the Green Bay Packers, his lactose intolerance, and his decided tolerance for tequila. Gomez studied business at the National University of Mexico, and Cantu says he was blessed with a talent for financial planning.
Most clerics run away from the accountants rather than run to them. He was one who embraced that, you know, of course, because, you know, that was part of his background. And he was able to really use that for the good of the church.
That love of numbers will come in handy in Los Angeles.
He still has the debt to pay off from the sexual abuse settlement, and that's a sizable amount of money.
That's Father Thomas Rausch. He teaches theology at Loyola Marymount University, and he's referring to the $660 million that the Archdiocese paid to victims of clergy sex abuse. That debt is part of the legacy left behind by outgoing leader Cardinal Roger Mahoney. Mahoney was also known for taking the church in a more liberal direction, including reaching out to gay and lesbian Catholics. Gomez will no doubt have to take a stance on that issue, given the ongoing legal battles over same-sex marriage in California. But as Rausch points out, Gomez is a member of the conservative Catholic order Opus Dei.
There's certainly a lot of challenges in dealing with the diversity of people who make up the church, including gays and lesbians. Will he move in more conservative directions? In some ways, he's going to be probably more conservative than Cardinal Mahoney has been.
For now, many of Los Angeles' 4 million Catholics are celebrating their new leader and giving him the benefit of the doubt. It's likely the Pope will eventually elevate Gomez to the post of cardinal, as he did his predecessor. It would be another milestone for the church. Gomez would become the first Latino cardinal in the U.S. For NPR News, I'm Sandin Totten in Los Angeles.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. School districts in New York are subject to what's known as the last-in, first-out rule. It mandates that the last teachers to be hired are the first to be dismissed whenever there are layoffs. Last week, the New York State Senate passed a bill that would end last-in, first-out. The bill faces long odds in the state assembly, but the Senate vote highlights growing frustration among state and local governments that are required to use seniority as the sole factor in teacher layoffs. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, provisions that favor senior teachers are under attack nationwide, but unions warn it's not that simple.
Like local leaders around the country, Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York says he will soon have to lay off teachers because of shrinking state aid. Bloomberg says he cannot have his hands tied by a system that judges teachers solely on their years of experience.
We need a merit-based system for determining layoffs this spring, and anything short of that is just not a solution to the problem we face.
Education reformers have argued for some time that relying on seniority alone gives the axe to young, promising teachers. They also say the seniority system causes mayhem in low-income schools, which tend to rely on a lot of new teachers. The anti-seniority forces got a boost from Secretary of Education Arnie Duncan this past week when he told reporters unequivocally,
I mean, if layoffs are based only on seniority, that doesn't help kids, and it particularly doesn't help the students who need the most help.
Many Democratic education reformers see seniority as an obstacle to reforms that favor more effective teachers. At the same time, Republican governors in Wisconsin and other states are trying to reduce the power of labor in the name of fiscal austerity. Unions, backed in a corner, say they're the only ones watching out for students. Michael Mulgrew, president of New York City's United Federation of Teachers, says budget cutters like Mayor Bloomberg are being disingenuous.
We are very leery, especially in times like we have right now, that people will try to say, just give us complete discretion, and then they will stop investing in education.
Opponents of seniority rules may have some momentum, but they still face an uphill battle against a practice that is enshrined in law in 14 states. The Chicago Public Schools tried to get rid of hundreds of teachers last year without regard to seniority, and a judge said, you can't do that. Karen Lewis, president of the Chicago Teachers Union, says seniority is the law, and ending it will just aggravate the already huge problem of teacher turnover.
50% of the teachers that enter the Chicago Public Schools leave within the first 5 years. We have a problem that we're going to have instability throughout our system, and that's the direction we're going in. This is what seniority kind of puts the brakes on.
Politicians rushing to get rid of seniority would do well to consider what happens next. Jeffrey Thomas of the Scottsdale Schools in Arizona says the state legislature there voted to get rid of seniority in 2009.
What they didn't do is they didn't create an alternative.
Thomas says his district is working on a point-based system that looks at teacher evaluations and other factors. In some places, negotiations over a new evaluation system may take months or years, particularly if districts want to throw students' progress into the mix. Jeffrey Thomas says districts that are already fighting their unions in court or in the headlines may never get those evaluations in place.
You don't vilify your union. You bring them to the table and you make them partners, because when you talk to your union leadership, they don't want to see bad teachers either. But what they do want to see is they want to see you treat them fairly if, in fact, you're going to go after performance issues.
Districts like New York City will not have time to develop a meaningful evaluation system before the budget axe falls. Mayor Bloomberg says he'll have to start making layoff decisions by the spring. That urgency may cause both sides to dig in their heels, which could leave seniority rules in place. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
CIA agent Dana Baer was supposed to be going undercover in war-torn Sarajevo, so she was a little surprised when her contact picked her up at the airport in a lime green station wagon.
I think Bob's joking when he points at the station wagon parked out front of Split Airport, the one we're about to drive into Sarajevo. It's lime green with a tangerine Orangina painted down the side. What's worse, it's right-hand drive, a British Vauxhall. Bosnia, Croatia, everywhere in the Balkans is left-hand drive. It just makes no sense to me, driving a billboard on wheels into a city the Serbs have been pounding with artillery and sniping at since the civil war started in 1992. Does he want to give them something to shoot at?
Not the most inconspicuous car for a couple of undercover CIA agents, but Robert and Dana made it to their safe house intact, and over the next few years, their professional relationship grew into something much, much closer. Robert and Dana Bear write about those experiences in their new book. It's called The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story. And they join me now from our studios at NPR West. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Let me first make it clear that you were not married to each other. You were married to other people when you first met at the CIA, right?
That's correct.
It happens so often.
And which we'll talk about. But you guys were at very different points in your careers. That day in Sarajevo that we just heard about, Dana, you were an up-and-coming field agent. Bob, this was almost sort of towards the end of your career. You went to the former Yugoslavia as a kind of a last hurrah.
Yes, I had a cloud over my head. I was in hiding, even within the CIA, because I had attempted to assassinate Saddam Hussein in 1995. And I knew that was a cloud that wasn't going to go away. And
this so was an authorized program, but then you were investigated for it.
It was absolutely authorized. I mean, I was missing one piece of paper. It was called a memorandum of notification. But that aside, that was a policy, and I tried to conduct the assassination, and it was, you know, they stopped it at the last moment.
So you went to Yugoslavia. You knew your career was coming to an end because of this investigation. You were eventually cleared. But what were you doing there?
We were going after Hezbollah. Hezbollah had attempted to murder the chief in Sarajevo. He was pulled out in the middle of the night.
The CIA station chief.
The CIA station chief, and we were sent in to go after these guys.
This is during the early part of the Bosnian War, right?
It was during the Civil War, yes.
Dana, what did you make of Bob when you first arrived to Sarajevo? I mean, he was your contact. He was the guy that you were sent to hook up with when you got there.
Right, and I was actually sent sort of in a support mission to support whatever his operation was there. And, you know, I was new, I was young. He seemed to do everything just contrary to how I was trained.
You know, my attitude toward operations, it's the purloin letter. You drive a lime green car, carry a gun around, you act like a fool if you want. And people look at you and say, well, that couldn't possibly be a CIA spy, you know.
One of the things in this book that is just amazing is how unplanned your lives are. You're given an assignment, and you go. Both of you had families. Dana, your husband was in L.A. Bob, your wife and children were in France. They can't ask you, how long are you going to be gone? Because you can't really give them an answer, right?
No, you can't give them an answer. You could come home, and they wouldn't recognize you. You know, they would sort of run to their mother and say, you know, who is this guy and why is he back and why is he disturbing the equanimity of this family? And you become an outsider. You live in this parallel universe and you come home and it's tough.
Most of the time in my case, you can't say where you've been or what you're doing. And it really takes the closeness out of a relationship.
So much of what you guys did seems like you had to have kind of a blind faith. Bob, you describe having to cross the border from Syria into Lebanon to meet with some people. You get into a car. You're driven. Your contact drives you to the border, over the border. You get out of the car in the middle of the night. There's another car waiting for you. Somebody else drives you somewhere else, drops you off somewhere else. I mean, huge risks that you just have to hope everything works out, right?
You better become fatalistic. Hmm. You know, you've put your life in their hands. You assume that you know which way the politics are going. You have a certain intuitive sense for what's happening politically. And if you don't, you die. Anyhow, I thought I knew what I was doing. And the Syrians took good care of me. They never said a word to me, by the way. Never introduced, never a name, nothing. Old Mercedes, drive the confrontation lines, get picked up by a local militia, driven across Beirut in the middle of shelling, show up at his leader's and, you know, pass the message to him, which couldn't be done over a phone. And you know, 2 weeks later, there was a coup.
I'm speaking with Robert and Dana Bear, former CIA agents, and they've written about their experiences in a new book. It's called The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story. Well, let me ask you about your work in Iraq, Bob. After you'd been there before with the CIA, but then you went back after the fall of Saddam Hussein. You went there as a consultant for ABC News. What happened when you got there?
ABC called us up about a couple of weeks before the war started and said, we want to send you into Iraq to contact the Sunni tribes. You're close to them. You've been for years.
This is the Dulaimi tribe.
The Dulaimi tribe, and we're going to send a cameraman with you, and we're going to photograph this as it happens as the Americans pass through Iraq. Good plan, but no cameraman with ABC News would go with me. So I turned to Dana. I said, oh, Dana's great at cameras. And we went there, and the last thing we were in Amman, and Dana said, is this safe, crossing the border? Because we had found a Bedouin who was going to trade us for 100 sheep to bring us across the border clandestinely into Saddam's Iraq. And I said, it's absolutely safe. I trust these people. And Jordanian intelligence thought it was a dumb idea and stopped us from crossing. Yeah, fortunately, because the following night, in fact, I can remember the day, it was 11th of April, the U.S. Air Force hit the house we were supposed to stay in with the Dulaim, killed our hosts, all of our friends, and that was our near miss in the Iraq War.
They thought Saddam Hussein was there.
Yes.
One of the things you guys talk about is this life in the shadows, that you never get any credit for what you do. I mean, even when you die, chances are no one's ever going to know who you were. Did you ever, Bob or Dana, did you guys ever do work that you thought eventually contributed to the capture or the killing of a dangerous person?
Honestly, I never knew, although there were instances of other people that I worked with that would sort of work in a country for a while, you know, targeting some specific terrorist and then be asked to leave the country and, you know, several weeks or a month later would hear on the news that the person they were tracking had been captured. So you really are a small spoke in the big wheel of things.
Bob?
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know if I contributed anything. I think if you sit back and look at this book, it's a little bit melancholy because you don't really have, you know, the product of your work in front of you. You're not a craftsman. It's just you are in the living and with a piece of the truth, and you don't know whether you've really made a difference.
That's former CIA agent Robert Baer and his wife Dana. Their new book is called The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story. You can read an excerpt from it at our website, npr.org. Bob, Dana, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
While some lawmakers are zeroing in on unions in their efforts to reduce government spending, many economists are recommending another target to relieve budget pressures, the retirement age. They advocate raising it to keep workers on the job longer, which would increase tax revenues and lower expenditures for government pensions and Social Security benefits. But other economists disagree. They say if older workers stay on the job longer, it reduces opportunities for young workers with new job skills. NPR's senior business editor Marilyn Geewax joins us to parse out the conflicting views. Good to see you, Marilyn.
Hi, Lynn. Good to be here.
So why do some economists say that lawmakers should raise the retirement age?
It's just simple demographics. The U.S. population is aging, and that means there are going to be fewer active workers paying taxes and more retirees collecting benefits. You know, the early eligibility age for Social Security benefits is 62 right now, and the Conservative American Enterprise Institute did a study that showed that if you just raise that to 65, the system would be in a lot better financial shape. And in fact, the whole U.S. economy would get a boost from having people work and pay taxes longer. In an age when there are fewer and fewer jobs that require a whole lot of physical strength, it makes sense to move the retirement age up, at least according to this argument.
Sounds like a pretty compelling argument. Why not do it?
Because if you're going to retire later, then you have to have a job in the first place. And the thing is, many older workers just don't. Since this recession began, the unemployment rate among people over 55 has been at the highest levels we've seen in 60 years. Here's what happened. When companies started laying off workers in those massive waves of layoffs in 2008, 2009, a lot of baby boomers lost their jobs, and they just haven't been able to find their way back into the workforce. So a lot of them decided to file for those early Social Security benefits that they could get at 62. And in 2007, before the recession hit, 38% of 62-year-olds asked for those benefits. In 2009, the figure was up to 42%. They started taking those benefits because they just didn't have a choice. Jobs weren't available to them. So some economists say that raising the retirement age would not keep people working and paying taxes longer. It would just increase the level of poverty among people in their mid-60s, people who could neither find jobs nor would be able to collect their early Social Security benefits.
Well, that would be really difficult for a lot of people, but it would help relieve budget pressures by reducing benefit payouts, right?
Well, that's actually another point of disagreement. When you balance a budget, you need tax revenues on one side to equal the spending outlays on the other side. So some economists say that if you're raising the retirement age, yes, you would reduce government outlays, but in the long run, you might make it harder to balance that budget by depressing tax revenues.
How would it hurt tax revenues?
Well, to boost tax revenues, what you really want are corporations paying lots of taxes on their really big profits. You want workers to have big incomes. And to do that, you need very productive, technologically advanced, innovative companies. And you look at the huge incomes and the profits that a company like Google has generated over the past decade or so. That's what you want if you want to boost tax revenues. To create those kinds of super fast growing companies, you probably don't actually need a large number of workers who were in school 40 or 50 years ago. In fact, a lot of corporations try to become more profitable by offering their older, higher paid workers incentives to retire early. They want to lower their payroll expenses while creating opportunities for younger workers who also have high rates of unemployment, but they have fresher job skills. My point is that this issue of balancing budgets is really very tricky. Right now, most lawmakers are focused on holding down government costs, but a lot of economists say they should also be worrying about how to boost tax revenues over the long haul by having companies with lean, innovative staffs.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Geewax. Thanks very much, Marilyn.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Text messaging is exploding, and that's an understatement. In 2005, cell phone users in the U.S. sent a total of about 7 billion texts per month. Last year, they sent 173 billion text messages per month. That's a monthly average of more than 600 messages per person. The main advantage of text messages is that they can be received on just about every mobile phone anywhere in the world. The main disadvantage? They're not secure. Sarus Farivar reports on a new startup that's been trying to merge the convenience of messaging with security.
When you send a text, there are at least three copies. There's one on your phone, there's another copy on the recipient's phone, and there's at least one copy on your mobile carrier's servers, not to mention any other carriers that it had to hop through along the way. In other words, when it comes down to it, text messages aren't very private. And that's why folks like attorneys and doctors can't use them for work.
So the big thing here is that you've got private information about clients, patients, whatever it is. And if you lost your phone, every message you ever sent could be grabbed by somebody.
That's Sean Whiteley, the COO of TigerText. He says his company's service doesn't send normal texts. Rather, these messages are sent entirely through an application and encrypted. The company says it lets users set an expiration date on how long that encrypted message stays on their servers. In other words, it deletes them when you want.
But with TigerText, since we destroy the messages, you're only liable for how long they're on there for. So once they're gone, you have the safety of knowing that there's less data that can be leaked.
They've gotten a lot of interest from hospitals. That's because TigerText is compliant with federal health privacy rules.
The biggest problem in the hospital, I'm really a hospital physician, is communication.
That's Dr. James French, an executive at the Moses Cone Health System in Greensboro, North Carolina. He explains how before TigerText, getting doctors in direct, secure communication with each other takes a long time. Remember, many doctors still use pagers, so it may take some time to get doctors used to typing on their phones.
I'm just typing in, is this patient ready? Is this, let me get this thing up here, because I'm an old guy, so I'm still getting used to this myself.
However, only 35 out of 40 doctors in Dr. French's group are using TigerText because they already have smartphones. The other five can still use it, but only through the TigerText website. But Dr. French says that he's confident they can roll the service out to the rest of the department and then the entire hospital in the coming months. For NPR News, I'm Sarus Farivar.
This is NPR News.